I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A Tale of Two Countries is a new book from the academic and former senior public servant Richard Sayan, who joins me now. In the book, he looks at the demographic imbalance in Canada that in the next two decades will see parts of the country aging at an uneven pace. It is the contention of this book that this will spell trouble for eastern Canada and for the country as a whole. The gulf between so-called have and have-not provinces will be starker. So what are the solutions? I'll get Mr. Sayan to tell us what's happening, what will happen, and what might be done to see this country, to not see this country tear itself apart. The book is evidence-based policy analysis as well as recommendations. Richard Sayan is the director of the Donald J. Savoie Institute at the University of Moncton, of which he was a former vice president. He is a 15-year veteran of the civil service with various departments, including the Privy Council Office, Industry Canada, and Transport Canada. His previous book was Over the Cliff, Acting Now to Avoid New Brunswick's Bankruptcy. This new book is published by Nimbus. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Moncton, New Brunswick today, Richard Sayan. Mr. Sayan, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome.
So when I think about the next 20 years and how this will affect me, I'm 34, I'm someone who is going to be affected by all of this in the coming years. I'm thinking, couldn't people of, say, the boomer generation, who were no doubt in government over the last 20 years or longer, have foreseen all of this?
Yes, absolutely. Population aging is a phenomenon that we've been aware of for a long time. The thing with demographics is obviously something that we can predict, and we very often... There's an old adage coming from the Auguste Comte, the founder of sociology, that said demography's destiny. And our own noted economist and demographer, David Foote, said subsequently that it explains two-thirds of everything. And, a lot of economists will tell you that their forecasts are not worth much, but when it comes to demographics, you can take it to the bank. So obviously, we knew that that Canada was aging. The problem with Canada aging at a highly uneven pace, though, is something that has only emerged recently, and that's because although the oldest parts of the Federation, Quebec and Atlantic Canada, have been aging faster than the rest of the country for long now, ever since the end of the baby boom, we exited the baby boom younger than the rest of Canada. So it took some time for us to catch up. But once we did catch up, boy, we aged much faster. So at the end of the baby boom, Newfoundland and Labrador is by far the oldest, youngest province in the Federation. Mm-hmm. It was barely 19 year old, so barely of legal drinking age, and I don't even know if the drinking age was 21 back then.
Yeah.
But now Newfoundland and Labrador is 45, so within only 50 years, it gained a quarter century in terms of median age, whereas if you look at Canada as a whole, it gained only half of that. So now that we've caught up, we're aging much faster and we're surpassing them, and it's at the very moment when aging starts to matter, because now baby boomers are exiting the workforce, therefore depressing growth, and as they age, as they reach the first baby boomer is now 70, turning on 71, we will see an increase in the spending on health care and elderly care generally.
Now, is the reason why we can't, is Canada like other Western countries where birth rates are declining?
Yes, absolutely. Canada was one of the four countries that witnessed the baby boom. The other ones were America, New Zealand, and Australia. Contrary to popular perception, the baby boom was not a universal phenomenon, but all countries are still witnessing declining birth rates. But what we're seeing is that in our region, they've declined much faster because our typical female is 45 and is no longer of childbearing age, whereas in, for instance, the prairies, the typical female is 36, so still of prime childbearing age. Same thing applies with immigration. Immigrants tend to come in when they're young and therefore of childbearing age, and provinces west of the Ottawa River obviously have much better migratory performances, whether it is receiving people from outside the country or elsewhere in the country.
Yeah, so I'm talking from Vancouver, is it safe to say that we out here don't have as much to worry about as, say, people in eastern Canada where you are?
Yeah, it's true, except for actually your province, Mr. Planta, because British Columbia has a higher concentration of seniors. Ever since the end of the baby boom, though, British Columbia has been aging more slowly, but in recent years it's aging at the same pace as Canada, but it has a larger share of seniors. So there will be greater pressures in British Columbia than on average in all of Canada. Not a big difference, but still a difference that's there. Your big advantage in British Columbia is that although you're aging, it is largely because the fertility rate is low, but you still have a lot of migrants coming in. And the thing with migrants is that they come in ready to work. Therefore, they boost economic growth. So you can expect stronger growth from demographics in British Columbia than, say, in Ontario or Quebec.
On the issue of immigration and its effect on, say, the future of this country, you're well aware of what's going on in Vancouver, I'm sure. With regards to foreign ownership of property in Vancouver itself.
Yes.
And so people are getting priced out, people that would like to live here, say, can't afford to get into the housing market. And so we're assuming because of that there won't be that tax base later on, because a lot of these foreign owners, say, are satellite owners. They don't live here regularly. So what does that mean for how you see the country in the course of writing this book? Does that play into it?
Well, there's the specifics of the Vancouver region and then the broader national imperative or the national context. Of course, in the short term, speculation in the market is something that is affecting affordability in Vancouver, and yes, it is a concern. But more broadly, part of the of Canada's ability to maintain a single social safety net will be its ability to grow its economy. And although Canada as a whole is, you know, doing better than provinces east of the Ottawa River, in Atlantic Canada in particular, the aging of a population is still depressing growth in Canada considerably. So just because we're aging, growth has been essentially cut down by about 40%. Once we could expect the economy to double every 30 years, like growing at 2.7, 2.8%, now we're down to 1.6, 1.7. We tend to blame the Great Recession and financial crisis that followed for Canada's subpar growth ever since, but actually it coincides with the first baby boomers retiring. So we have a country that's growing slower, and the only way to get more working-age people into Canada in the short run is through immigration. Because if you have more kids, it takes 25 years for a kid to be prepared for, ready to go to in a workplace. So the solution in the short run is immigration, and I applaud the government, or at least the commission that studied this topic, for increasing Canada's immigration flows. But that will be a challenge. It's dependent on a variety of variables, as you know. So in over the next 20 years or so, I think this is one area where we will have to stay focused and try to increase these numbers. And I suspect that Canadians, over time, might be more open to greater immigration flows, as long as it's well managed, because they'll realize that we need it for our economic prosperity. I'm saying they'll realize it even more, because we already do realize that.
And at the same time, I mean, it's one thing to encourage immigration and to have it rise in numbers, say, but the social implications, I mean, people getting along with each other, I mean, is that something that's factored when people are saying bring more people into this country?
Well, obviously, our ability to welcome immigrants is dependent on a variety of factors, including social, economic, and even geopolitical factors. But Canada is a surprisingly large immigration flows compared to a country such as even just the United States, for instance. So far, we've proven very welcoming, and you know, in Toronto, you have more people foreign-born than born in Canada. So, or at least it's on the cusp of being more people born outside the country. So, I suspect that this is part of our fabric now. I'm not too concerned about that. But obviously, a lot of Atlantic Canadians would wish that there would be a more balanced distribution of immigrants across the country. But that's hard to do, because immigrants are just like anybody else. They will go where there are jobs, where they have cultural affinities with people, and where they have access to a decent social safety net at a good level of taxes. And in Atlantic Canada, I'm saying that the environment that we have for economic growth is more important than anywhere else, because in a place like British Columbia, the sheer presence of a large cosmopolitan city such as Vancouver is a magnet for migrants. we don't have the same assets for immigration here in Atlantic Canada.
So what could people in Atlantic Canada do better? Governments, say, what could they do better to attract immigrants?
Well, here I think it's very much in the trenches. If you want, although a lot of people say that we don't need more immigrants in Atlantic Canada, just in New Brunswick, for instance, we still have a job bank where, last time I checked, it was around close to 4,000 vacancies, vacant positions. So obviously, as society ages, we have a situation where we have both unemployment and jobs available. Because the unemployed people do not always match exactly the requirement. You can't always turn a skilled as a chemist into a physician or vice versa. So we have these challenges, and we're going forward with a pilot project to draw more skilled workers and semi-skilled workers in the region. And I think we're headed in the right direction. But we shouldn't expect miracles on the immigration front. I think at best this is something that can help a bit. But I think that the solution lies in, first of all, doing our best from our end to better manage our existing activities. We've built hospital networks at the time when transportation was difficult. And in my own province, we have something like 23 hospitals, whereas we're the same size as Quebec City with only about 6 hospitals. So we can do better there, obviously. We're a more rural province, so of course we probably need more institutions. But I say that we won't be able to sustain 23 hospitals without further help from Ottawa. Same thing with demographic decline. As school enrollments decline with the population decline and the aging of the population, we should be more aggressive in recalibrating our system to reflect our demographic realities. So we have a lot of homework to do at home here. We also have to, in my view in the book, I clearly say that we have to have a more receptive approach to natural resources development. In Atlantic Canada, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick, we're quite reluctant to look at issues such as fracking for shale gas or oil, but we will take the money from BC, Alberta, and Saskatchewan in return. And I think there's a moral inconsistency there, and unless we don't want to frack, if we don't want to frack for oil and gas, it's fine, but we shouldn't take the money.
Yeah.
Because down the road, what we will have to be doing is going back to Ottawa and say, well, if we want to maintain a single social citizenship in this country, if we want one system of free universal health care, then we need to revisit fiscal federalism to make sure that Ottawa provides enough money to all provinces for them to meet their commitments, their obligations towards citizens. So it's the very future of the welfare state that's at stake here, and I think that we need to at least start discussing this issue here domestically in Atlantic Canada. It's a bit difficult to have that conversation because it requires facing the prospect of major change. But we also need to have that conversation nationally because, you know, we're going to go and see other provinces at the very moment that you guys, if I can say it that way, are going to slow down too because of an aging population. So we need to build an understanding of the problem and start to discuss solutions.
Well, where do you see the relationship between provinces and the federal government in the next 20 years, say? I mean, do you see the federal government willing to cede jurisdiction and not to say money, in terms of healthcare spending on education?
Well, there's a couple of things here. The first one relates to what we used to see, and we still do to a certain extent. We see provinces coming in unison and asking for more money from Ottawa. And that was logical when all provinces were aging at mostly the same pace, not aging at the same pace, but at a similar age structure. But now, eastern provinces will increasingly come to see Ottawa and say, we need more. And perhaps some provinces, I don't know, Saskatchewan, Alberta, or even Ontario, down the road might say, well, why should we give more to receive less or just the same in exchange? So we might see a dilution in the common front, outside money for infrastructure. Our infrastructure is always popular. Mm-hmm. So that's the first point. The second point is the center of gravity in this country is moving west fast. In the last election in 2015, 30 seats were added to the House of Commons. We went from 308 to 338 seats, none of them in Atlantic Canada, 3 of them in Quebec, 27 of them west of the Ottawa River. So in barely one election, we added the political weight of almost the entire region of Atlantic Canada. So our voice is getting diluted, and the Senate, being unelected in Canada, can hardly do its job of representing regions properly. So in a sense, it's not exaggerated to say that much of our fate hinges on decisions made in the Prime Minister's office in Ottawa. So it's a very precarious position to be in, and obviously in a situation like that, we need to be talking to other Canadians so that other Canadians become more familiar with our problems here.
What are you finding in terms of, because we've been listening to this over the last 20 years, that the city will have more influence than, say, the province, a province.
Yes.
I guess mayors aren't really concerned about healthcare or education as much as, say, infrastructure.
Yep.
So, I mean, do you think that, so it really is the purview of the province to be concerned, and quickly.
Yeah, but at the same time, the province will be competing with cities for federal dollars.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen the language, and I'm sure it's the same thing in British Columbia, but in Ontario, we've seen Ontarians, particularly around Toronto, articulating the view that we've moved into a post-national world in which global cities have to compete, and that Ontario can no longer be subsidizing other regions when it needs to invest in its own city to be competitive globally. So that kind of provincialism, if you want, or even Torontonism,
yeah,
if you want to call it that way, is language that competes with the broader narrative of fiscal federalism. And Ottawa, we have to be reminded, Ottawa itself is going to be facing the pressures of aging because it's responsible for old age security, and that is one of the fastest growing components of federal spending in Ottawa. So the timing could hardly be more difficult for provinces to make a case for more money, but at some point we will have to recognize that some provinces will need more in order to maintain the welfare state in Canada. And I think the issue is, I use the title, A Tale of Two Countries. I think that demographically speaking, this is not arguable. There's at least two countries, if you want, within Canada. But the concern here is that we would have two countries in terms of the welfare state. And this is very difficult for Canada because the main element of national identity in this country, the element that defines us most, if you read polls by, for instance, in Veronic, they poll on the Army, the Queen, the RCMP, the national flag, the Constitution. But the one element that comes most often is still healthcare. And when CBC had this show called the Greatest Canadian of All Time,
right,
it wasn't Johnny McDonald or Wayne Gretzky or Maurice Richard they chose. They chose Tommy Douglas. So healthcare defines us as a nation, and it's hard to change. It's a sacred cow. We don't want to make any changes to healthcare, but we do realize that it's kind of like an element of our social citizenship. So this is very much what's at stake here. It's not at stake right now, but in 10 years from now or 15 years from now, half of the baby boomers will be 75 and above, and there's a geometric cost escalation as people age. So this very much in 10 or 15 years from now where we're going to see potentially two countries emerging in terms of our social citizenship. And I think that in a country that defines itself based on the healthcare system, that's explosive politically.
Yeah, and so the worst case scenario is that the country comes apart.
Pulled apart at least from the perspective of the welfare state.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if a union such as Canada can sustain that kind of a shock.
Yeah.
So we will have to find an answer to that, or else it will have dysfunctional political implications.
Now, in terms of what the people want, I mean, do you think they're concerned about, say, I mean, a savvy politician will say, well, if we want to sustain all of this, the sort of welfare state that we want, that would mean increasing taxes.
Yes.
Do you think the public is there at the same place?
Well, here only time will tell, but frankly, taxes are not as high in Canada as they were barely 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Federal tax burden as a percentage of GDP is down 20%. So there is room to increase taxes there, and if the federal government lowered taxes, some provinces picked up the slack. And it's interesting because, as I said, east of the Ottawa River, we're aging faster and we're facing more pressures. And when Harper vacated the GST in 2006 and 2008 by 2 points in total, West of the Ottawa River, not a single province has fully captured that fiscal room. East of the Ottawa River, all of them did so. So that tells you that the fiscal pressures are uneven. And my view is that Canada as a country, if Canada was a unitary state like France, I think that a dynamic, immigration-friendly, and resource-rich country such as ours could withstand the shock of an aging population. The question is whether we will be able to reinvent ourselves as a federation so that we distribute more wealth to the provinces that need more. And we have a principle in the Constitution that says that the Parliament of Canada is committed to ensuring that provinces have sufficient revenues to ensure comparable services at comparable levels of taxation. Mm-hmm. But right now, that principle acts only on revenue. That equalization principle acts only on revenues. In the past, this was an appropriate approach, but because we had relatively even means. But in the future, and I would say even right now, we have greater needs in our provinces. But this is just a principle, and some people say that it's at best aspirational. So it doesn't, just because it's in the Constitution as an aspirational principle doesn't mean that we'll be able to act upon that. So So the issue is, how will Ottawa respond to this principle to honor at least the principle of the Constitution? And on this one, my view is that only time will tell. It's Canadians and their elected leaders who will determine whether the welfare state tells a tale of two countries.
Now, do you see amongst the three or four major parties nationally, anyone there prioritizing this issue taking upon the demographic imbalance in the future, say?
Interestingly, in 2015, of the four parties, there was only one that said that it was explicitly said that it was committed to factoring in age in providing federal transfers, particularly the Canada Health Transfer, and it's the only party that did not stand a chance of winning the election. It was the Green Party. Once the NDP started seeing that they were not a contender, then they had softer commitments, trying to say that perhaps they would. But the main parties didn't do so, and the reason for that, in my view, was that it's not because they don't read the news. They're very well aware that we're aging unevenly, but they're also aware that a growing and strong majority of voters live in the lands west of the Ottawa River. So that will be the challenge. It's political leaders only reflect the nation. So the challenge will be, is does the nation have that willingness to sustain one social citizenship across the land? And my view is only time will tell.
Do you think we do, though?
I am one voter, and I say I hope we do. Yeah. Particularly where I live, you know what they say about politics: where you stand depends on where you sit.
Yeah, but I mean, you said earlier, you know, demography is destiny, and I'm sure, you know, as someone who follows politics, who knows history, do you have a sense of where we'll be 5, 10, 15 years from now?
I'm saying that we will respond, but probably with a lag. We went through two world wars, the greatest depression in the history of modern capitalism, and we built a welfare state that now is the main thing that defines us as a nation, at least the healthcare system. So my sense is that we will eventually respond. The problem is that at times the political response follows the actual events and doesn't anticipate it. So how much damage will be done, I really don't know. I'm hopeful that we will find a solution, and I'm hopeful that we will start discussing this issue very soon. It is possible. Right now, ministers are discussing the Canada Health Transfer, and it is possible that the government could allocate more money to faster-aging provinces. But at this point, it would only be a prelude to the actual show, because we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of the impact of population aging on healthcare spending. As I said, the first baby boomer is only 70 years old. So It's in 10 or 15 years from now that we will see a major, major pressure on our systems. And I can tell you that in a region such as Atlantic Canada, we're already barely, you know, holding our heads above water, so we can't see a doubling of our spending. Yet this is what we can see if nothing is done. And in 20 years from now, Atlantic Canada per capita could be spending twice as much as British Columbia or Alberta. So obviously it's a real problem, and as I said, though, I don't have a crystal ball.
It's unfortunate, because I think that's what we'd want, don't you think?
Yes, but yeah. I did analyze trends as best as I could, and I do provide recommendations in the book, and I think that the reader there could probably, at least start getting a sense of how big is the issue and what eventually would need to be done.
Yeah, it is a critical issue, especially for people my age, because we're going to have to live with this stuff, right?
And I guess what's interesting here is that although it is a critical issue, it is also a parenthesis, historically speaking, because it is predominantly, at least the uneven aging of the country, is predominantly a result of our region having more baby boomers, just because our baby boom was stronger and we didn't refresh our population through immigration and birth. So, unfortunately, baby boomers will eventually, as a generation, disappear. So it's like a 30-year parenthesis, and after that, growth should resume and the pressures on social spending should lessen somewhat. So it would be a shame that we would destroy one of the most important one of the elements of our citizenship just for a 30-year issue. And often, you know, if we don't go into debt too much over the next 10 to 15 years, then maybe we would have the capacity to add more debt just to go through this generational hump, if you want.
Yeah.
But we have to be careful because we're already pretty indebted in certain provinces, so this is not really available to provinces as ours. So it's going to be a challenge.
Yeah. Well, this is a fascinating book in terms of getting us started thinking about these important issues. I appreciate your time today for this conversation. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. The book is called A Tale of Two Countries, How the Great Demographic Imbalance is Pulling Canada Apart. It's from Nimbus Publishing. Its author, Richard Sion, joined me on the line from Moncton, New Brunswick, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.